The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online. Plus, we'll give you a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to the Americano podcast, a series of discussions about American politics, power and prejudices. This year, 2024, is an election year in America, a presidential election year. And so we will be doing two podcasts a week rather than our usual one because we want to and because we know you can't get enough Americano in your life. We are honoured today to be joined by Gerard Baker, who is editor-at-large of The Wall Street Journal, and he writes a column, a free expression column for The Wall Street Journal and a column for The Times newspaper here in England. Gerard is in New York at the moment, and we're going to be talking asking the question, why do Trump's enemies always overreach? Jerry, I thought about asking this question because of your most recent Times column, which dealt with this story that has been talked about a fair bit, but it really is indicative of what happens to Trump in politics, which is this speech he made about the car industry, or he was talking about the car industry in a speech, and he used the word bloodbath, and he was obviously talking about bloodbath in relation to the car industry, but the media inevitably took it as him threatening a bloodbath if he wasn't elected. And it just seems to me that we have been experiencing this with Donald Trump for such a long time, and yet it keeps happening. And why is that, I suppose, is my first question.
Yeah, it is. It's a good question. As you say, it's a very, very familiar phenomenon. We've seen it literally from the minute that Trump announced that he was running for president 9 years ago. There have been some most memorable examples of it. I cited a few of them in my column last week when he supposedly, to this day, there are people who will tell you that Trump, after the Charlottesville horrors in 2017, when he was president, if you remember, when there was a riot led mostly by sort of neo-Nazis and right-wingers, Trump speaking the next day, famously was talking about people there being good people on both sides. It was very, very clear from the context of what he was saying that he was talking about people on both sides of the debate about whether or not you keep Confederate statues. He was saying that's clearly what he was talking about. This was immediately just interpreted as, and to this day still is, that Trump said that there are good neo-Nazis out there. So, you know, it's been going on for so long. I mean, I think the answer, Freddie, is that I think the real answer is that the people who do this, the media sort of crowd who continue to just look, Trump says lots and lots and lots of crazy and stupid and often very bad things. So there's enough material out there without having to stretch it. I think part of the problem is that these people live in this bubble. They only ever live in a world in which people think, all the people that they know think Donald Trump is the greatest threat to democracy, an evil person, a terrible human being, and who will destroy the country. And indeed, you know, doesn't subscribe to any of their kind of views about race or gender or indeed anything whatsoever. And so I think they feel that if they can feed that frenzy by just by using everything he says, kind of appeal to those people by sort of, you know, it's like you can imagine sort of people getting together and sort of saying, oh my God, isn't he terrible? Can you believe what he just said now? And that's what they do. And I think they do it, again, largely to feed that appetite without really understanding damage that they do to their own credibility in the process, or the fact, in fact, they're not reflecting what Trump has actually said as on these occasions, or that they are further distancing themselves from large numbers of people who actually may not like Trump very much, but are prepared to sort of, you know, at least listen to what he said and give him a chance. So I think it just is, sorry for the long-winded answer, but I think it's just reflective of this media kind of left-wing, progressive, sort of hermetically sealed society in which you can say anything about Trump because people are prepared to believe anything you'd like to say.
And to what extent do you think it's a digital media phenomenon in that it's clickbait, and Trump has always been good clickbait, actually slightly less than he used to be, which might see things changing a little bit in the way he's covered. But, you know, you put Trump warns of bloodbath. That's inevitably going to drive clicks, and not just clicks from people who are horrified and in the medically sealed bubble. Quite a lot of Trump fans will instantly click on it because they go, oh, I bet he didn't say that. And that's what I found interesting about this bloodbath story is that the number of people who knew, even though the stories were still saying he warned of a bloodbath, who knew instantly that that wasn't what he said.
Yeah, I think that's a good. I think that is a good point. I mean, again, I remember when I'd been out. It was a Saturday, I think, and I'd been out, and I checked my phone, checked my Twitter X feed, and I started seeing all these tweets from people, these posts from people saying, "Oh my God, Trump is but even or not, Trump's said that there's going to be a bloodbath if he doesn't get elected." And yeah, and I had exactly that reaction. I thought, okay, I'm going to look at that and see whether that what he actually said. And of course, it took precisely 30 seconds of watching the video to realize that Trump was talking in a very specific context. Yeah, of course it is. And this is, I'm sorry to say this, Freddie, but this is so much of our world, the world you and I operate in too, which is that if you say something extreme, outrageous, that is the most dramatic interpretation of any events, whether it be something Donald Trump says or, to pick another very topical subject, the subject of Catherine, Princess of Wales's health, you will get attention. You'll get clicks. You'll get noticed. You'll get retweeted, reposted, whatever. You will be, and that's what it's all about, right? I mean, everybody wants to see their, their likes, their tweets, their reposts or whatever, want to see those numbers clicking up. So I'm sorry. Yes, it is, unfortunately, the media environment in which we live. I mean, I think, the struggle, obviously, for you and me and for, people who are, let's hope, are trying to do decent journalism is to resist that temptation. But I will be honest, find it in my own world. I write two columns a week. If I write a column about Donald Trump, again, I don't ever, I hope, distort either in favor, negatively or positively, anything Donald Trump ever says. But if I write a column about Donald Trump, I know that will get, hundreds of thousands of views. If I write a column about, which I quite often like to do, about, what is happening to, the U.S. economy and where interest rates are heading, it's like, fine, it's an interesting column, but it'll get 10,000 views. So, yeah, this is the world in which we live. We occupy this world where the more you pick a popular subject, and the more outrageous, the more provocative, the more extreme you can be about that subject, the more attention you're going to get.
Yeah, I promise we will get onto the American economy at some point. But for now, we're going to do a bit more on Trump. As much as, I think the media do deserve a lot of criticism, and we should beat ourselves up at all times because the media has been terrible in its coverage of Trump generally. It's not just the media, is it, when we're talking about Trump's enemies? It's the justice system. It's the Democrats. I mean, if you look at the legal campaign against Trump, it is so obviously overreaching to anyone who's rational. And, as you say in your piece, you don't have to think that Donald Trump is innocent of any criminal activity to see that this is an absurd persecution, I think is a fair word to use.
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, look, it's the same phenomenon at work in the political field that we've just talked about in terms of maximizing audience. If you're an ambitious prosecutor in Georgia or New York, to take the two salient examples, whether you're, like Alvin Bragg, the Manhattan DA, remember, it's so important to remember, of course, always important to remember for an international audience, these are elected positions. You get elected district attorney in Manhattan through New York is obviously a Democratic state, and Manhattan is a Democratic city. You have to be a Democrat. So you get elected, you win the Democratic primary. That's your aim. And then you get elected by the broader population. So in order to do that, you want to do things just in the same way that, the extreme, the tweeter or the media person trying to get maximum hits, you do something, you pick a juicy target when you're a prosecutor. And there's no juicier target for a Democratic audience, for a Democratic electorate, than Donald J. Trump. That's exactly what both Alvin Bragg, who is the Manhattan DA leading this, what is honestly a very, very flimsy case against Trump, which is the Stormy Daniels payment, allegedly a breach of federal election law. He's leading that case. Both Alvin Bragg, who's doing that case in Manhattan, Letitia James, who is the Attorney General of the state of New York, also an elected position. She was elected, and by the way, She is a strong contender to be the next governor of New York. That should tell you probably almost all you need to know. She ran. They both ran for office, but she's leading the civil cases against Trump, which he's in immediate financial trouble, trying to find money to come up with the cover the bond that will enable him to appeal this fine, this $450 million set of fines that he's got. Both Letitia James and Alvin Bragg, as I say, not only are Democrats elected in a Democratic primary, they both campaigned to their highly partisan Democratic voters on the proposition, on the platform, that they would prosecute Donald Trump. Fannie Willis, who is the prosecutor in Fulton County, Georgia, where he's facing the charge that he acted illegally in trying to overturn the election result in 2020. Also a Democratic prosecutor, also elected, also has political ambitions. Probably they don't stand much chance now since some of the revelations about her personal life. She's got political ambitions, but an easy way to promote those political ambitions is to lead a prosecution of Donald Trump. So yeah, it is, it's the same incentives at the legal level, at the juristic level, that operate at the media level, which is you want attention, you want preferment, you want publicity, and the way you can do that is by prosecuting Donald Trump. Again, just to quickly say, as you said in your question, Donald Trump is not, it's very hard to have a lot of sympathy with Donald Trump in terms of some of his legal problems. Donald Trump has, sort of walked between the raindrops of the law for a very, very long period of time. And I say it now, and I've said it many, many times, what he did after the election in 2020 was disgraceful. And my view, he was impeached by the House of Representatives. He should have been convicted by the Senate. But that, by the way, and he wasn't. But that I believe, is the proper forum for this. But what you have, it is quite striking. I go around the world and I talk to people and they say, how can the Americans possibly elect someone who's been indicted 94 times and maybe, may actually be convicted? And I do have to explain to them the heavily politicized nature of the U.S. judicial system. Unfortunately, that's just the way it is. And Democrats have, it's always been political. There's always been politicized prosecutions. Democrats have taken it significantly further with Donald Trump. And so that's a very large part of what we're dealing with right now.
And it's symbiotic too, isn't it? Because while it benefits in the short term, it certainly benefits these prosecutors to go after Trump, to raise their profile and so on, and ditto the media. You can do quite well attacking Donald Trump. Ditto something like the Lincoln Project, which gets enormous amounts of money from attacking Donald Trump. It also benefits Donald Trump very, very clearly. You can do a graph from the moment that mugshot was taken in Fulton County jailhouse of Donald Trump to his poll, from his polling, and it's just gone up and up and up since then, really. And yet they continue to do it, which suggests to me there is perhaps something inherently self-destructive about it, but it's operating on some very weird level that I'm not sure anyone quite understands.
Well, there are two things to say. I mean, firstly, in a sense, if you're an ambitious Democrat and you see advancements through the a lot of politicians are lawyers after we see advancement through the legal system, the political/legal system where you have elected prosecutors. By the way, you not only have elected prosecutors and you have elected judges. I mean, the judge who levied the fine against Trump in New York is another Democrat elected judge. So if you pursue those, to some extent, you don't really care about the wider national political ramifications, that this may not go over well with, certainly won't go over well with Republicans, but may not even go over well with a lot of, impartial independent voters because they don't like the smell of it. Doesn't really matter. I mean, what you're looking to do is to advance your position within the Democratic Party to become governor of New York or to become a senator or ultimately maybe, who knows, even be surprised if some of these people end up trying to run for president themselves. So they're very focused. This is part of the kind of unfortunate state the United States is in these days, where all that matters is your ability to appeal to like-minded people, to appeal to Democrats. Look at someone like, the extreme example of this is the sort of the left of the Democratic Party. Oh, by the way, there's a counterpart on the right of the Republican Party too, but my favorite example is Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the congresswoman who is the sort of firebrand, one of the most prominent members of Congress. She was elected. She ran in a primary against an incumbent Democrat. She was elected, I think it was 16,000 votes out of 450,000 votes in the district where she was running, because she only had to appeal to those activist Democrats who came out to vote in the primary. So that's part of the phenomenon that I think they don't really care, really, if what impact their actions have on the wider public, the wider electorate, as long as they're enhancing their position with their own voters. And the second thing, I think this is a little more speculative and even Machiavellian. There's always been a view, I think, on the Democratic Party side, and they may yet be right about this. I shouldn't completely dismiss it, that actually Trump is their best friend in an election. It's a double whammy, if you like. It's a twofer, as they say over here. You know, you enhance your position with your Democratic voters. You bolster Trump among Republicans, because Republicans see all this persecution, as you call it, as completely unjustified. So you rile up Republicans to vote for Donald Trump. And then Donald Trump has a pretty proven track record of not doing very well in national elections. He still hasn't won a popular vote in national elections. And there are a lot of Republicans, I think they're probably mistaken right now, who think that Trump is their best, their maybe only hope of Joe Biden being reelected in November. So again, that's a sort of a slightly more Machiavellian and highly risky strategy, but they have done it. Democrats, remember, have done this with sort of Trump supporting candidates in Senate and governor races across the country over the last 4 years. And they've done it with some success. They've literally helped, you know, they've actually spent money or organized things to help Trump supporting Republicans win Republican primaries, so that the Democrat can then run against the Trump supporter in the general election, where he or she is more likely to lose to the Democrat. So I think there's an element of that too, that in some ways it's a threefer, because they advance their own position in the Democratic Party. They like going after Donald Trump. It gives them, you know, tremendous jollies. And thirdly, it actually increases the probability that Trump is their opponent in the general election, and they think they can beat him. So there is a kind of there's an absolutely reinforcing logic to it.
Yes, that certainly does seem to be Team Biden's strategy, is perhaps sotto voce. They talk about Trump as though he is a kind of Marine Le Pen type figure, like Marine Le Pen in France, where, you know, the left can rely on getting in because they know that Trump will split the right and the centre well enough and is off-putting enough to enough people. But as you say, it's a very risky strategy. If you look at the polls now, I mean, in every single battleground state I saw on Real Clear Politics this morning, Trump is ahead quite significantly in the big ones like Georgia and Arizona and North Carolina. I mean, if it backfires, it's one of the greatest oopsies in political history.
It is. No, I agree on it. And look, it has backfired in the past. I think to some extent they weren't actively doing this, particularly in 2016, but there's no question that Hillary Clinton's people thought that Trump was the candidate she could beat in the general election of all those Republican candidates back in 2016. And they were actively, you know, kind of rooting for Trump, at least, let's put it that way, back then. And again, since then, they've taken even more active measures to do that. It is risky. And I think it's particularly risky right now because of two things. One, Joe Biden, who is an incredibly weak candidate. I mean, his approval ratings are lower than any president who's ever been elected, way below any president ever been elected at this stage of presidency. If he doesn't improve in the next 6 months, he's facing almost certain defeat. And secondly, because I've written my Wall Street Journal column about this this week, which is published tonight, I think the belief has always been that, look, whatever Trump's character may and all his legal issues may reinforce his support among Republicans, which is a risk we have to take, that they'll come out and vote for him. But it definitely turns off independent voters. And that's fine. And this is the Democratic strategy. And I've spoken to Democratic pollsters. They think they get to September, October, November, and they're just going to be hammering home January the 6th, Donald Trump, terrible man, democracy in danger, you can't vote for him, don't do it. And that still does have resonance with a lot of independent voters. And let's be absolutely clear, a lot of independent voters are definitely turned off by Donald Trump, and particularly by what happened on January the 6th. The problem, this is the problem, is that those concerns are being, inevitable pun I'm afraid, but trumped, massively superseded by voters' concerns about what's going on in the country. And beyond, you know, they're not looking back to January the 6th or what happened after the last election. They're alarmed about immigration, rightly. Immigration is literally out of control in this country. They're alarmed, remain alarmed about the economy, despite the fact you read a lot about how good the economy is. Prices are still way higher than they were 4 years ago. People are still behind in terms of real wages catching up. They're alarmed about the state of the world, and they don't really see great leadership from Biden, whether it's on Ukraine or on the Middle East right now. And they're alarmed generally about the kind of state of decline that America seems to be in. So the risk that they've taken, Democrats, in pursuing this lawfare, as it's called, or by kind of always exaggerating Trump's flaws and weaknesses and, frankly, you know, appalling aspects of his character, is that they've always calculated that would in the end resonate more with voters than concern about the country. But actually, it does look as though, you look at all the polling, people are so concerned about where the country is and so convinced that the country was better off 4 years ago under Trump that they are prepared to look past, at least as far as polling goes right now, they're prepared to look past those political characteriological questions they have about Trump and think, you know what, I just want to vote for him because the country's in such a terrible mess.
Well, Trump is lucky, as you say, with his enemies. He's also very often lucky with his timing. I mean, the two issues that are bubbling up as the most prominent, as you suggest, are immigration and the economy. It's usually one of those two, but they're both very, very at the forefront of voters' minds. And those are two things which, particularly immigration, they think that it was better under Trump, which it was, that there wasn't the illegal immigration crisis that there was then. And they think the economy is better. And what I'd like to ask you about the economy is we hear a lot from Trump, as we call them, the elites, about how great the American economy is going. You know, The Economist did a cover on it last week. And yet people don't feel that way. Do you think the Democrats are right to bet that regular people, voters, most voters, will start feeling better off by November? What are the chances of that?
The economy is definitely a split picture here. There's no question that in terms of growth, unemployment, the normal numbers that we've been used to looking to for the last 20 years or so, the U.S. economy has performed reasonably well. I say reasonably. It's important to put this in context. It's performed relatively well against the rest of the world. There's no question that compared with Europe, compared with the UK, even compared with China, you know, the great growth engine of the last 20 years, and compared with Japan, the major economies of the world, the U.S. has done well in the last 2 years. It's recovered far more of its way above the GDP that it had before the pandemic. Well, it's advanced way further than other countries on that. It's had sustained growth over the last couple of years, quite strong, relatively strong growth by recent standards. Unemployment is low, below 4% still, which it's been for a long time now. And so all of those numbers, yeah, they do look good relative to the rest of the world. They look good. And relative, I think, to where we were in 2020 with the crisis caused by the pandemic. So those numbers are good. The problem is an obvious one. I know it's very much the same in the UK and indeed in certain parts of Europe. The problem is inflation. Now, it is true that inflation took off, as we all know, after the pandemic, partly as a result of supply chain disruptions, partly in the United States. It was no question it was fueled by Biden administration and Democratic policies that pumped huge amounts of money into the economy, into an already supply constrained economy. Inflation rose very, very rapidly, hit almost 10% in the summer of 2022. It has been coming down since then. It's absolutely true. And it's now down at about 3%. But there are several things to say about that. Firstly, 3% is still too high, and it's certainly too high for the monetary policymakers who believe that sustainable long-run inflation should be 2%, so they are still concerned about it. It remains stubbornly around 3%. It did come down rapidly, as I said, from its peak of the middle of 2022, but the last few months it actually continues to be showing signs that it's staying at about that level. But the critical thing, especially in terms of its electoral implications and how voters think, is that price, you know, we have to distinguish between the price level and the rate of inflation. Because prices went up so much in 2021 and 2022, particularly things like, prices for food, food prices went through the roof here in that period. they rose, they are still, and even though inflation is, the rate of inflation, i.e. the rate of price increases, has come down, it still means that not only did prices rise very high in those, in that period, in that first initial period, but they've stayed high and in fact have continued to climb a little bit higher. So people are paying 25-30% more for a pint of milk today than they were when Donald Trump was president. Now, the key thing is that wages, if wages had gone up by 35 or 40%, you know, people still wouldn't like, people still don't like inflation. Economists have established that even when real wages are rising, but they feel more comfortable. In wages have not kept pace with inflation. They've started to rise in the last year, but in those first 2 years, they fell behind. So there is no question that for a lot of people, they are actually worse off. You have to add to that the fact that interest rates are very high. So if you've got a mortgage, if you've got, you know, here a lot of people have car loans, student loans, your credit card debt. Credit card interest rates are up at 20-25% right now. Because interest rates have risen to fight inflation. So all of this, you know, so you have this split picture of an economy that, yes, is generating growth, is generating jobs at a reasonable clip, and certainly at a better clip than most of the rest of the world. But for Americans who were 4 years ago had a picture of low unemployment, solid growth, and prices were flat, and their real incomes were rising, that's not been the situation for the last 4 years. So it's not a surprise that people do give Joe Biden low marks for the economy, because they feel less well off than they did 4 years ago.
And a lot of people say that their country is on the wrong track. I think record numbers, up until recently, record numbers of respondents to polls say that. And that makes me wonder about a very interesting column you had in the Wall Street Journal recently about how we're really in sort of Weimar America, which I think is something that people talk about a lot. And that's not just to say that, you know, Donald Trump is a would-be dictator and so on, but that the atmosphere, the political atmosphere, is very highly charged. And I wonder if that relates to the economy. And also, as you point out, it's not just people on the right, it's people on the left are using a sort of political language that is extreme.
So to be absolutely clear, I mean, I sort of addressed the question of whether this is what America is, you know, Weimar Republic. And I really firmly asserted that it isn't. There were so many things about the Weimar Republic. You know, it had been around when Hitler came to power, it had been around for, you know, precisely 14 years. You know, inflation, you know, we worry about 3.5% inflation. They had 10,000% inflation at various points in the 1920s. They had a Great Depression that had just hit them. They had, you know, political instability, an electoral system that almost guaranteed political instability, political violence, therefore, et cetera. So there's that, you know, so that comparison is overdone. My point in that column, and I do think it's an important point, is that the way in which apparently perfectly kind of civilized, normal, actually quite sort of prosperous and quite what one thinks of as reasonably healthy societies can become poisoned, which is largely the situation Germany was. Now, again, the other thing I mentioned, of course, is that Germany, you know, the other big difference is that Germany had just lost the First World War in 1919 and, you know, in humiliating circumstances with all kinds of controversy and everything else. That, again, doesn't apply to the United States. But there are, I think you can see the way in which people can be, their frustrations, just perfectly normal, you know, people who aren't, you know, genocidal fanatics. Most Germans even in 1933 were not, you know, genocidal fanatics. Of course they weren't. But the way in which, you know, perfectly civilized people can become so frustrated with their circumstances and so led, if you like, by kind of unscrupulous political leaders, and I'm not making the explicit comparison between Donald Trump and Adolf Hitler, but you can see how you can have leaders who can exploit people who, through direct appeal, this is the appeal of populism, direct appeal to the people over the heads of institutions in which they no longer have trust. By the way, that's really critical. And I wrote a book last year on how Americans' trust in their institutions had collapsed in the last 20 years, and it's really striking. So when someone comes along and says, you can't trust any of these institutions, whether it be the judiciary, whether it be the federal government, whether it be big business, whether it be technology or anything else, you can trust me, that does have a resonance and appeal. And the other point I kind of made in that column is the other thing that struck me about going back and reading that period, Germany in the 1920s and 30s, was the subjugation of all things to kind of totalitarian ideology. And this is, I think, a lesson for the left here, that we have, the Nazis had this, subjected every, the whole point of a totalitarian ideology, of course, is literally by definition, everything has to be directed towards the, or understood in the context of the ideology. And that was whether, so that's why you had Nazi physics and Nazi mathematics. And we have a bit of that on the, we have a lot of that on the left here right now with this obsession with identity, with the obsession with race and gender. And so we have, the idea that math is racist, or that physics is racist, or that all of these things. And I was struck by when you have unscrupulous, ideologically committed people on either side, in the context of an environment in which trust in institutions and in the very the basis of society itself, which is what happened in Germany in the 1920s and 30s, the institutions of the Weimar Republic. When you have that combination, you are quite vulnerable to extreme to the advance of that extremist ideology and the success of that extremist ideology. And I think right now that there is, again, I'm not here saying this is the United States is Germany 1933, but it is just really valuable to go back and understand why it is that perfectly kind of sane, normal, civilized, decent, ordinary people can be tempted by and persuaded by these ideologies that end up causing such astonishing horrors as Nazi Germany. I just think we need to be continually conscious of that.
And is it the case that you can talk yourself into a Weimar situation? I mean, I think of Biden's speech last year. Was it last year or the year before? Last year, I think, the Philadelphia one. With the backlighting and the two Marines behind him, where he started talking about, MAGA extremism, which has become a refrain of his. And when you start talking about extremism, when you start talking about, as many people do, as you say in your columns, many people do talk about Donald Trump as a Hitler in the making, then you almost create the political climate that you describe.
Yeah, I think there's something to that. I mean, I think part of the problem with the Hitler analogy, we may as well just address it head on here, is there's not really an ideological basis. I mean, you can go back, as I have done, you can go back and read Mein Kampf, and there amid the kind of hysterical, paranoid, nutcase rantings of, a deeply, deeply, deeply troubling and troubled man, with a kind of, with no question, the outlines of an ideology, profoundly, fanatically anti-Semitic, profoundly nationalist, calling for massive expansion of German borders for Lebensraum and all of that kind of stuff. It was, there was the absolute core of a fanatical fascist ideology there that remarkably he was able to and did actually execute in power. Trump's the problem, one of the problems with sort of Trump, casting Trump as a kind of dangerous fascist, is I don't discount Trump's, let's say, anti-democratic qualities. There's no question with Trump that, and we saw again after what happened after the last election, I don't think Trump would stop at trying to, as he did, trying to overthrow the results of an election, as he did in 2020. There isn't, however, it's hard to pin Trump because there isn't really that ideological. It's with Trump, it's all about himself. It's all about advancing himself. And he does it. He manages brilliantly. I will say this brilliantly. Maybe there are echoes of past, totalitarian leaders here. Brilliantly managed to connect with people, advance his agenda in ways that persuade people that it's actually their agenda too, or in their interest too. Because I don't think Trump, honestly, candidly, I don't think Trump gives a damn about, regular Americans. And in fact, his entire business career has been built on essentially screwing, whether they be, subcontractors in his business or ordinary Americans who sign up to his ridiculous schemes. But I think what he does, is able to do, speaking to a lot of his voters, is they just see in his language that he talks about things, whether it be like immigration in particular, or kind of the loss of community, the sense of the communities being hollowed out. They see in his language things that they identify with. So again, I think the back to Biden, labeling Trump supporters as sort of fascists, he kind of did, semi-fascist. I think he said many of them. He said a semi-fascist. I think misses the point in a way. I think you may be right. Maybe it does. It talks the country into this hyperventilated environment of crisis. But I think it also misses the point in that these are not people actually who I think are really sort of, you know, voting for someone with a particular ideological, a set of ideological objectives. They are people who, for whom Trump channels their frustrations with what's gone wrong with the country. And I think that's the problem. Again, that comes back, you know, back to the point about the media and Democrats. That's what they so miss the point of Trump. And this is, to me, one of the most frustrating things is that again and again and again, you know, they like to believe that Trump is this sort of jumped up fascist that they can't understand why anybody supports him. And it's just the country was basically fine until 2016. And along come this crazy, dangerous man who destroyed everything and is now turning the country into Nazi Germany. And they just miss the point why people felt the strong desire to vote for such an evidently flawed man themselves is because they just had enough of the way their institutions had been driving the country and leading the country for so long. And I think Biden's and the Democrats' emphasis on the threat to democracy is, while again, I think it has some elements of truth to it. And I don't want to misstate this. Trump, I think there are many things about Trump and his behavior that disturb me. They need to do you can't do that and not address the concerns that people had in the first place. And actually, what the Democrats have done is made those concerns even stronger by pursuing this radical progressive agenda that Trump, that Biden has done in office. He's actually further radicalized voters to the degree that he now faces, you know, a serious prospect of defeat and the serious prospect of Trump being elected, perhaps even with an even stronger share of the vote than he got in either of the previous two elections.
Jared Baker, on that note, I think we'll end it there. But thank you very much indeed for coming onto the Americano podcast. And I do hope we'll get you on again before the election.
Great. It was a great pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's all for this episode of the Americano podcast. I'd like to thank my brilliant producer, Natasha Farrows, and urge you to leave a generous, kind and warm-hearted review of this podcast on whichever platform you listen to it.